Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Killett, your host. So happy to be back here. Thanks for being with us. Hope you had a good weekend. We had a very sad weekend here in San Diego, the Padres. We're all sad. We're trying to get over it, but we're all sad around here. If you'd like
those who care about sports ball may be sad.
They were a very good sports ball team. They did a very good job at sports ball this year.
Oh, good.
Second hour, Don Johnson is going to be here. We'll talk about his new movie, Disconnected, and we'll talk about the whole transgender movement. Your calls, of course, welcome.
Are you going to ask him about Miami Vice?
He does get asked that quite a bit. So I think I'm going to do... now I forgot the name of that other show that Don Johnson was in, but it's a different Don Johnson.
Okay.
This hour, that's Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. We've got a little bonus open forum for you on this Monday afternoon. 888-318-7884 is the number. 888-318-7884. Jimmy. What is that the theme from?
That's the Miami Vice theme.
I was wondering if that was. I never really was a Miami Vice guy. I never watched it.
Neither did I. But I saw images from the show, and I would listen to electronic music, and it's an electronic music song.
Yeah. Again, 888-318-7884, the number 888-318-7884. Any question at all, welcome for Jimmy Akin, who I mentioned is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, also the author of a whole bunch of books, including The Bible is a Catholic Book, and the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where last week the second Cuban Missile Crisis was discussed, the one you haven't heard about. This week, what drops, Jimmy?
No, that was 2 weeks ago.
Oh, man, am I really that far out of time? Sorry.
No, just like Billy Pilgrim, you become a little unstuck.
But not that far.
So last week was part one of Ellen Gould White, the Seventh-day Adventist prophetess. And so last week we told the story of Ellen Gould White's life, including how she began to what happened to her before she was a prophetess, what was happening around her in religious Christian American society at the time, how she then began to see visions. We talked about her first vision and a little bit about some other ones, like a really cool vision where she got to go to other planets. How cool is that? Having God giving you a vision where you get to go to other planets. And so this week we're going to be going into analysis mode and testing her to see, you know, how reliable are her visions. And I'm going to be approaching this in a different way than I see a lot of people approaching Ellen White, because what I see most people doing, including most apologists, is they will use arguments of the form, Ellen Gould White teaches X, X is contrary to my belief system, therefore Ellen Gould White is a false prophetess.
Right.
And so, like, for a Catholic, it would be, well, she teaches this thing that's contrary to the Catholic faith, therefore she's a false prophetess. And, well, okay, so if you're a Catholic, that's true. But what that does is it reduces this to a theological fight. You're not really doing a paranormal investigation. You're not really looking at the issue from a nonpartisan point of view. You're looking at it from a specific point of view and saying, well, I disagree with her theology, therefore she must be false. But I don't find that, I find that problematic in a couple of ways. The first one is, just because someone is not in your tribe theologically doesn't mean that God can't talk to them. God loves all of his children and he can talk to whoever he wants. And so, like, I've done analyses on Mysterious World where I looked, like, for example, at Father Michel Rodrigue, who is a Catholic priest. I concluded he's a fake. His visions are false. He's either a knowing fabulist or an unconscious fabulist, but his visions are fake. On the other hand, I also looked at a Protestant gentleman named John Hendricks, who lived in Tennessee in the early 20th century. He's known as the Tennessee Prophet. And despite the fact he's Protestant, I concluded there's good evidence his visions of the future were true. So God can talk to anybody. He can touch anybody with his grace. And you don't want to simply reduce it to a theological fight. And so we're going to be looking at Ellen White's prophecies, not from an apologetic perspective, but from a broader perspective, and saying, what does the evidence, taking the theology out of it, what does the evidence suggest about whether these were genuine, authentic visions or not?
Very good. So that'll drop this Friday. So you can already watch the first episode.
Yes.
Or listen to the first episode, however you do it. And then the second one will be down. We'll drop. We'll be down. That's not how we do it. It will drop on, I guess you and drop down.
People
Friday.
Can get down with it on Friday.
Get down with some Ellen Gould White audio. 888-318-7884, the number here. Nash Bridges, by the way. That was the show that I was trying to think of that Don Johnson was in. Apparently not as popular as Miami Vice. 888-318-7884. Emma in Hayden, Idaho, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Emma, glad to hear from you again. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. So my question is, if God is outside of time and he can dip in and out, could we be in heaven right now or hell? Have we met our destination? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, I do. So this is a common question. A lot of times people will kind of reason this way. They'll say, well, God is outside of time and God is in heaven and we're going to go to heaven. Therefore, we're going to go outside of time. And if we're outside of time, that means that from an eternal perspective, we're already in heaven or hell because we're no longer in time. The problem is that there's, and I won't go into all the details, but there's, unfortunately, there's a logical fallacy in the reasoning. You can kind of get a glimpse of the fallacy if you think about it this way. If I were to say, well, when I go on vacation, I enjoy myself. And when, well, actually, let's scratch that. I'll go simpler. The basic problem is God is outside of time, but all created beings are bound by time. And so it's true that God is outside of time, but that does not mean that we can transfer that fact to everybody who is in heaven is outside of time. What heaven is it's a state. Now, it may correspond to a place, because people have bodies in heaven, like Jesus and Mary and so forth. But everybody who's in heaven, and ultimately ultimate destiny is to be here on the new earth. But the essence of heaven is it's a state of spiritual union with God, where we see the beatific vision. And that's something that happens inside of time. So we, as time-bound creatures, will always be inside of time. So we do not leave time. Angels are inside of time of at least some form. Humans are inside of time of at least some form in the afterlife. We can tell that there is a progression of events and thus some form of time that occurs in the afterlife, because first you die, you lose your body, then you have the particular judgment, then you wait, you go to purgatory if needed, you get done with purgatory and experience the full glory of heaven. Then at some point in the future, Jesus comes back and you're resurrected. Then we have the general judgment, and then we have the eternal order. So we can see the progression of the soul through these different events. And that means that there is either time or some kind of time that we experience in the afterlife, because there's progression from one state to another. And that's what time is. It's the measurement of progression from one state to another. So we will always be within time. Our union with God will be a spiritual one, and he in his essence is outside of time, although he is capable of interacting with time, including becoming incarnate in time, as he did with Jesus. And Jesus in his humanity up in heaven is still inside of time. He didn't leave time. He still has his human nature, and his human nature is measured by time. So Jesus is still in the incarnation inside of time. Now, could we, though, adopt a perspective outside of time and see what our fate is? Well, sure. So if we adopt God's eternal perspective, where time does not pass and all times are equally real to God, then at least according to the position that I would advocate, not everybody would advocate this, but I would, God sees the beginning of our lives as real to him, God sees our present state as real to him, and God sees our eternal destiny as real to him. They're all equally real from an eternal perspective, but that's an eternal perspective. That's one outside of time. It is not true that here in 2022, we are simultaneously outside of time in heaven or hell. We're never outside of time. Suppose we've reached our eternal destiny by the year 3000. Well, okay, it's true that in 2022, we're inside of time in this life. It would be true that by the year 3000, we'll be in our eternal destiny. But that's in the year 3000. That's still in time. And every subsequent year in time will still be within time. But we're, and so if I don't reach my eternal destiny until the year 3000, I'm not already there. I'm already in 2022, but I'm not already at my eternal destiny. So I hope that helps out a little bit. It is a difficult subject to think about, and it's even more difficult to communicate in words over the radio without diagrams, but I hope that's helpful.
Thanks, Emma. Appreciate your call. We got to take our first break. We'll do that and be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live. Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
This is Dr. Ray Guarendi from The Doctor Is In. You call in, and we will talk about what matters to you in your life. We can put our heads together to help you solve the problems of life and to use your faith to get even smarter.
The Doctor Is In with Dr. Ray Guarendi. Tomorrow afternoon, 1 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Hey, you know that audio, the little booklet we have that we're trying to give away, half a million and then a million, and then David says up to 10 million copies of them. If we can give them away, if we can raise the money and give them away so that they will help in the pro-life movement, it's called Why We're Pro-Life, and it's now available as an audio book. You can download yours today. Just visit whywearprolife.com, and download your copy of Why We're Pro-Life as an audiobook. The number here is 888-318-7884. We go now to Orlando, Florida. Eddie in Orlando, watching on YouTube. Eddie, glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. Yeah, go sports ball. That's what Jimmy says sometimes.
Mm-hmm. I was Augustine's comments on the first chapter of Genesis, the creation narrative, mm-hmm. and I just was blown away by the nuance in it. So I was wondering if, and he was really brief in those comments, so I was wondering if Jimmy could elaborate a little bit more on what St. Augustine said about the creation narrative in general.
Okay, well, I haven't read what Scott wrote about that, so I don't know what he mentioned and what he didn't mention. St. Augustine's... Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Because I'm so sorry. Yeah. What he mentioned was how he broke down the days, and he broke them down more in a metaphysical, spiritual level. Like, he created the heavens and earth, but when it meant heavens, it meant the angels, per se. And when there was light and darkness, it was mentioning the struggle that we see in Revelation between Satan's rebellion and all that, and then leads into creation. So I was just wondering what else did St. Augustine say about that? Because honestly, I was really enthralled by,
by that narrative. So St. Augustine realized, and if you want to read about this, I mean, you can read St. Augustine's own writings. There's a book out that he writes about this in more than one place. One of them is in a work called On the Literal Interpretation of Genesis, but I'm thinking of a volume that includes both that and some of St. Augustine's other writings on Genesis, because he's also got a commentary and some things like that. But basically, St. Augustine, you know, knew, like people in the ancient world did, that the sun is not stationary in the sky relative to the earth. I mean, from an earthbound perspective, from the surface of the earth, it looks like the sun moves around the earth every 24 hours. And so at the beginning of the day, at dawn, the sun comes up in the east, and then it arcs over the course of the sky, and then it sets in the west. And he recognized that during the nighttime hours, the sun is elsewhere. The sun is on the other side of the earth, or what was at the time called the Antipodes. And it moves, it doesn't sink into the water, you know, it's not underwater illuminating the water. It's on the other side of the earth, which he recognized as being a sphere, because that had been recognized since the time of the Greek philosophers, that the earth is actually a sphere. And it moves around from the perspective of the earth's surface. It moves around the far side of the earth, and then it comes back up in the east every morning. And given that, it's the presence of the sun that lights up the sky and makes it daytime. And so St. Augustine, in reading Genesis, noticed that, hey, we've got the day-night cycle starting on day one. You know, there's God creates light, and then he separates the light from darkness, and then he names the dark part night and the light part day, and there is a day, the first day. Well, God doesn't get around to creating the sun until the fourth day. So Augustine, like some other early Christian writers, including, for example, Origen of Alexandria, said, okay, this can't be literal then. If we have a day-night cycle happening on the first 3 days, we've got day and night, and yet there's no sun to make it day. So that's a clue that the sacred author is communicating information to us about what God did, but he's communicating it to us in a literary way rather than a literal way. And St. Augustine then said, okay, so what these days are doing are telling us about what God did, but we shouldn't try to read a chronology out of them. Instead, Augustine tended to think of creation as as something that happened all in a moment, as an instantaneous event. But because of the depth of creation, the way Augustine read the days was as highlighting different aspects of that instantaneous event. And that is one way to read Genesis. It's not the way I would read Genesis, because we have more information scientifically now. I think Augustine is right that the days are not meant to be literal. Where I would disagree with Augustine is thinking that creation was instantaneous. Today we have evidence that the earth is very old, and that the universe is even older, and that it came to be in its present state through a long process of development. Development just being another word for evolution. And so there was a cosmological evolution that happened after the Big Bang, where stars and galaxies and eventually planets like ours formed. And then here on Earth, there was a biological evolution where life began, and then it grew into more complex forms. And all of that happened under God's providence. But that process of creation, that process of development, wasn't instantaneous. Based on our modern scientific understanding, it's something that took a long time. So I think Augustine was wrong in thinking of creation as instantaneous, but I think he was right in his reading of Genesis and saying these days are not meant to be literal. They're meant to communicate information to us about what God did without telling us the details of when God did it. So that's kind of a general overview. I mean, I could say more, and I've talked about it more on other occasions, but that's kind of a general view that I could sketch for how Augustine regarded this and how I would kind of put it in context.
I'm going to leave that there, Eddie, because lots of folks on the line, but thank you very much for the call. The number is 888-318-7884. It's open forum with Jimmy Akin this hour. You are welcome to call. Dave in Peoria, Illinois is next, listening on our website, catholic.com. David, thank you for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you very much for having me. I was having a conversation with one of my Catholic relatives, and they have a very simplistic, beautiful faith, but they don't understand many of the doctrinal matters of the Church, and I was struggling to explain to them why I, as a Protestant, even though I do believe in the vast majority of the dogmas of the Catholic Church, and I've been able to explain to them many of them that they struggled with, they long for me to be able to partake of communion with them at Mass, and I've always declined, and they're always trying to invite me to it. And they say, but even the priest says, come, all of you, you know, take all of you and drink, for this is my body, this is my blood, you know, the verses from Matthew. So I was wondering if you can explain it in a way that they would understand, because I was struggling to do so.
Sure. So when the priest uses the words, take this, all of you, and eat of it and drink of it and so forth, he's repeating words that Jesus used. But the words that Jesus used were directed to a particular audience. You know, he was talking to his own disciples. He was not talking to, say, the high priest Caiaphas, who was going to put him to death. He was not talking to Pontius Pilate, the governor, who was going to put him to death, who didn't even worship the God of the Jews. He was not talking to Caesar over in Rome, who himself was being worshipped as a god. And so when we seek to understand what Jesus said, we must recognize that he was talking to a specific group of people, namely his disciples, people who had fully embraced faith in Jesus and who accepted his teachings. And as a result, we can't extend the all that he refers to beyond the disciples. He means all of the disciples. And even then, there are some unstated limitations, like St. Paul indicates in 1 Corinthians, that even though the Corinthians were Christians, some of them were not receiving the Eucharist worthily, and they shouldn't be receiving it. He says that some of them are experiencing sickness and even death because of the way that they're improperly receiving the Eucharist. So not only do you need to be a disciple of Jesus, you also need to be receiving in a proper way. And that's why, for example, Catholics who are in mortal sin need to go to confession before they receive the Eucharist, so they can receive in a state of grace and receive in a proper way, unlike what some of the Corinthians were doing. So even though Jesus uses this very broad-sounding language, we have to recognize the limitations that are implicit based on the situation in which Jesus was speaking, you know, because he's at this private supper just talking to his disciples, and also based on other things we know, like from what St. Paul says. So as a result of that, we see that this invitation is not meant for everybody in the world. Well, fortunately, our Protestant brothers and sisters share much of the Catholic understanding of the Christian faith, and that's great. However, they don't share the full understanding of the Christian faith that Catholics do. And so from a Catholic perspective, they're on the same team. They're fellow brothers and sisters in Christ, but they're not fully, they haven't embraced the fullness of the faith, and therefore they wouldn't fully count as fully educated disciples. And as a result of that, the Catholic Church has rules about who can receive the Eucharist. And there are limited circumstances in which a Protestant could receive the Eucharist. But as a general matter, one needs to be in full communion with the Catholic Church in order to be able to receive the Eucharist. The Eucharist is sort of a sign of being in full communion. At least that's one of its normal functions, is it represents that we are fully in church communion with each other if we can share Eucharistic communion. And we shouldn't ignore these laws of the church. So that's kind of a basic understanding that I would sketch for your relatives. I think it's great you're talking with them and great that you're studying the Catholic faith. And I'd encourage you to keep doing that and also to keep calling in here on the show.
Thanks, David. More to come.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Matt Swaim here. Tuesday morning on the Sunrise Morning Show, we'll celebrate St. Crispin's Day and get you all the latest news, weather, sports, and a whole lot more. Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. It's Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and Thomas is here with some questions from TikTok. TikTok has become very, very popular, and so Thomas finds challenges to the Catholic faith or questions about the Catholic faith from TikTok and brings them to Jimmy sometimes, and then you take the answers and then you post them on TikTok. Is that how you do it, Thomas?
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
This is a segment that we like to call "The Padres Aren't Going to the World Series." Thomas, go ahead with your question.
Sorry, I had almost made it like a full minute
without thinking about that
and spiraling again.
I apologize.
So, after I pull myself out of that, I'm going to ask Jimmy this question. Well, it wasn't really a question. It was left on one of our videos. Not really apropos of anything that was in that video, but you know, sometimes people just come out swinging, and
Thomas knows the word apropos.
Yes,
cool.
He do.
2 points.
Yeah, words good.
That's good.
Sometimes
you're up to two.
I'm up to two.
Up to 2 points. Yeah. So those, when we add those together with all your other points, you're up to two now, Thomas. Congratulations.
I'm thinking about baseball again. This guy said, He said, Catholics leave out the real second commandment from the Old Testament. What's that about?
Okay, so this is about not exactly what you'd think. The Ten Commandments are found in two places in the Bible. They're found in Exodus chapter 20 and Deuteronomy chapter 5. And they're worded a little bit differently on those two occasions, but it's the same basic content. And we're also told that there are ten commandments, although the word commandment is a little bit misleading. In Hebrew, the word for that's used for commandment is davar. And davar doesn't literally mean commandment. It literally means word. And so these are the 10 words of instruction to Israel. But because they tend to involve commanding things, we call them the 10 commandments. In any event, the 10 commandments are a little bit lengthy. You know, they go on for several, you know, for several hundred words. And as a result, they're hard to memorize. And so what every community does is they prepare shorter, memorable summaries of the Ten Commandments, you know, where they're just very brief, like, you shall not have any gods before me. You shall not make any idols. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. Remember the Sabbath day, things like that, really little short summary statements. Whereas if you look at the originals, like the discussion of the Sabbath can be really long, but it all gets compressed down to just remember the Sabbath day. So there's a complicating factor in that when you look at the text of the Ten Commandments, both in Exodus 20 and in Deuteronomy 5, if you're looking for commands, there's actually more than 10. There's like 14. But we're told that these 14 statements, these 14 exhortations to do or not do stuff, they need to be grouped together in such a way that the total comes out to 10, because we're told there are the 10 devarim, the 10 words. And there are different ways of grouping them together. One way has become common in Catholic and Lutheran circles. Another has become common in Orthodox and Calvinist circles. And there's still another one in Jewish circles. And so what happens is, if you look in everybody's Bible, the same text is there. Catholics have not deleted one of the commandments from their Bibles. If you look in a Catholic Bible at Exodus 20 or Deuteronomy 5, you'll find all the material there. But because there's a need to group them together and summarize them to make short little memorable summaries, and because there's ambiguity about how are we supposed to group them together, there's like three different systems that have been proposed, that means that not everything shows up in the little grouped summaries. And so what happens in the Catholic Lutheran version is the commandments, you shall have no other gods before me, and you shall not make any idols, those get grouped together as one commandment. And in the shortened summary form, it just gets, you shall not have any gods before me. It gets turned into that. And the unstated part is, don't make any idols. And so that will cause people who use the Orthodox Calvinist version to say, ooh, you guys deleted the second commandment. You deleted the part about idols. Well, no, we didn't. It's right there in our Bibles in Exodus 20 and in Deuteronomy 5. It's still in our Bibles. It's just not mentioned in the shortened summary form, because polytheism and idol worship were basically the same thing in the ancient world. If you were doing one, you were doing the other. If you're worshiping other gods, you're worshiping idols. So on this reckoning, that's really one commandment. And you know who agrees with that? Jewish people. If you look in the Jewish reckoning, that's one commandment in the Jewish reckoning. So what happens at the other end of the Ten Commandments? Well, in a Protestant version, you will have, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, and you shall not covet your neighbor's property. But in the Protestant version, or in the Orthodox Lutheran, Orthodox Calvinist version, that gets grouped together as a single 10th commandment. And so you could turn the charge around on someone coming from the Calvinist perspective and say, you guys are deleting the 10th commandment. At least you're not mentioning it in your shortened summary. But what's really happening is we're just grouping the commandments, grouping the commands differently. Because you can say, look, if you're coveting your neighbor's wife or if you're coveting your neighbor's property, they're still both about coveting. And so there's really kind of one commandment there, kind of the same way that if you're worshiping other gods, you're also worshiping idols. That's really kind of one commandment. And neither group is really deleting a commandment. They're just summarizing them differently. Well, what happens if you group the idolatry and polytheism commandment together? And what if you group the two coveting commandments together? That would take you down to 9 commandments instead of 10. So where would the 10th one come from? Well, there's an introduction to the 10 commandments in both Deuteronomy 20 and in Exodus 5, and it says the same thing. I am the Lord your God. Cy Kellett, does I am the Lord your God sound like a pretty important word you might say to Israel?
It sure as heck does. Yes.
Kind of like you might introduce all the other words you want to say with it.
Right.
Well, that's the Jewish understanding. On the Jewish counting of the Ten Commandments, the first commandment is, I am the Lord your God. And so a Jewish person could turn around and say to a Christian, you guys are deleting the first commandment, the most important of them all, I am the Lord your God. Really, it's just different ways of summarizing this material to make it easy to remember. But I actually think that the Jewish reckoning is probably the original one, the one that the original author had in mind, where I am the Lord your God is the first commandment. Do not have other gods before me, and do not make idols. That's the second commandment. And do not covet your neighbor's wife or property. That's the 10th commandment. And so the church actually doesn't have a teaching about which of these is right. If you look in the catechism of the Catholic Church, it says that this catechism uses this one that's become traditional in Catholic and Lutheran circles, but it doesn't insist that this is the uniquely correct version.
Got it, Thomas?
I think so. That was about as thorough as you can get on that question. So thanks, Jimmy. I look forward to seeing how people try to dodge that one next time.
All right. And I'm not going to repeat that title that I gave about the Padres and not going to the World Series and all that. Mark in Somerville, South Carolina, listening on 7:30 a.m. You are up next. Mark, go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hi. So I reverted to the Catholic faith probably about 2 years ago. My wife and I got married in the Protestant church, and I was a Protestant back then, and little did I know she had a lot of anti-Catholic beliefs. And where we're at now, we have a 2-year-old son.
Yeah,
super thrilled about that. She is, as I grow deeper in my faith, I'm learning about the theology of the body, and I am against using contraception. However, in the evangelical church, there's been a movement away from that, where contraception is favored. And so I'm in a spot now where if I'm going to have relations with my wife, I essentially, she's requiring that, and when I go to confession, I need to have full contrition and a resolve to not do the sin going forward. And so I feel as though I'm not actually able to go and receive reconciliation, knowing that in the future she's going to require contraception. And so I'm kind of in a place where I just don't know where to go, and if I say, hey, this is where I'm at, she's threatened divorce in the past for other sort of Catholic beliefs. Do I rip apart the family?
Let's let Jimmy address that, Mark.
So Mark, I understand where you're coming from, and a lot of people have been in this situation. The good news is that Catholic moral theology actually does not require you to refrain from having relations with your wife in this situation. Catholic theology has articulated a set of principles. Their formal name, or they're often called, the principles of cooperation with evil. And living in this world, you know, filled with fallen sinners, you got to cooperate with other people. And sometimes they're going to do things or require things that are not what God would want. So there are ways in which we can remain morally pure and nevertheless cooperate with people who are doing or insisting on things that are not themselves in accord with Catholic moral teaching. And this is an example of that. There's a document that came out from the Holy See something like 20 years ago called the Vademecum for Confessors. A Vademecum means a little guidebook. And so this was a guidebook prepared for priests who hear confessions. And one of the things that the Vatican pointed out in this is that it can be legitimate for a Catholic spouse to continue to have relations, sexual relations with their spouse, even when the spouse is insisting on contraceptive behavior under certain circumstances. Those circumstances were as follows. The first one is the Catholic spouse, and in this case you're a man, so I'll say him, the Catholic spouse himself is not to do anything wrong. And secondly, the Catholic spouse is to let the other spouse know that, you know, they don't approve of contraception, and the Catholic spouse is, you know, should seek opportunities when it's reasonable in the future to try to help the other, the contracepting spouse, come to a new understanding of this issue. So that can just be praying for the person privately. It can be, you know, if the subject comes up in the future and they seem a little open, you know, say, hey, maybe we should, can talk about this. But as long as the non-contracepting spouse is doing those things, it can be legitimate to continue to have marital relations, even though the other spouse is using contraception. So I would say that actually there are ways that you could continue to engage in marital relations for the sake of your marriage and your family. And if you would like more education on that, or like what those specific situations were and how to, you know, kind of negotiate a situation where you can both live with your consciences, you might want to contact the National Catholic Bioethics Center. Their website is NCB Center, NCB for National Catholic Bioethics. So ncbcenter.org. They're in Massachusetts, and you could arrange a consultation to talk with one of their medical moral experts, and he could guide you through the situation. But basically, you would be able to continue to have relations with your wife, even if she's using contraception, as long as you're not doing something wrong yourself, as long as she knows that you don't approve of the contraception, as long as you look for opportunities to help her, you know, revisit this issue in the future, and as long as there's a need, like preserving marital harmony and keeping the marriage going for the sake of both of the spouses and the family, which obviously there is. So, so I would encourage you to be hopeful on this. There are ways to address the situation and find a way of living together despite your different views on contraception.
And I'm going to leave it there because we got to go to a quick break. I hope that was helpful for you, Mark. We have to take this break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
It's so very important that everybody out there not just love Jesus. We all need to fall in love with Jesus. We can't do anything until we fall in love with him. And what that means, and we can totally understand it as human beings, when you fall in love with someone, you do anything for the beloved.
We have a big problem. Our culture is dying, and souls are in danger of being lost. The answer is conversion to Jesus Christ in His church. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a Catholic organization, and we have hundreds of teams spreading the good news throughout the country. But we need your help. The harvest is great, but the laborers are few. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Next hour, Don Johnson will be here. Not that Don Johnson, the other Don Johnson. Don Johnson, the evangelistic filmmaker and author, and he'll be here to talk about his new film, Disconnected, which is about the effect that the current movement of transgender ideology is having on young girls. And on girls, 10, 11, 12, 13. All the way up into young women. It's a fascinating and somewhat upsetting topic, but we'd love it if you'd join us. If you have questions about all that, call us next hour. The number here, 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin with us this hour. It's Open Forum, and Sandy in Sharon Springs, New York, listening on 89.9 is next. Sandy, thank you for waiting. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Jimmy.
Hi, what's your question, Sandy?
Under did help a period of time. Hi, Jimmy. When Pope St. Gregory introduced the Gregorian calendar, did he drop a period of time? Was it a correction or a miscalculation?
It was a correction. So the calendar that was in use prior to the Gregorian calendar is known as the Julian calendar. And it goes back to Julius Caesar, who lived in the first century before Christ. The Julian calendar is based on an even older Roman calendar, but the older Roman calendar kept getting out of sync with the seasons because the length of the year in days was not precise enough. And so Julius Caesar made a correction to the calendar that resulted in a year being 365 and one quarter days long. And that helped keep the calendar in sync with the seasons. That's close enough that the figure 365 and a quarter days is very close to the actual length of the solar year. And so that helped for centuries keep the calendar in sync with the seasons. The problem is 365 and a quarter, or 365.25, 0.25 for a quarter, is not exactly the solar year. Instead, the solar year is more like 365.2422 days, rounded to the nearest 10,000th. And that means that if you're reckoning the year as being 365 and a quarter days, even though it'll take longer, the year will eventually start to drift out of sync with the seasons. And so by the time of the 1400s, 14 centuries have gone by. And so there's been 14 centuries of a tiny amount of drift happening. And as a result of that, the year had become out of sync with the calendar by like almost 2 weeks. And so there were astronomers, including Nicholas Copernicus, who started studying this issue and trying to determine the length of the year more precisely so they could propose something for the Pope to fix this issue. And eventually, Pope Gregory the 13th did. He announced the new calendar, which is called the Gregorian calendar, and that involved skipping almost 2 weeks of days. Now, they didn't change the Saturday, Sunday. They didn't change the days of the week, but they leapt over about 2 weeks in the calendar to get it back in sync with the seasons. And that's why sometimes you'll read older documents that will say this is the old style or OS of dating versus the new style or NS of dating. The old style is the Julian calendar. The new style is the Gregorian date for the same thing. And after Pope Gregory announced the new calendar, it began to spread first in Catholic circles because Catholics are the ones who listen to the Pope. Others didn't immediately adopt it. There were some holdouts, like in Protestant England, they didn't adopt it for a few centuries. In Orthodox Russia, they didn't adopt it for several centuries as their civil calendar, which is why they actually had November revolutions that were in 1917 in Russia that were reckoned as happening in October. Because they were using different calendars. And even today, some Eastern churches continue to use the Julian calendar for their liturgical calendar. But eventually, the Gregorian calendar became the standard civil calendar that's used all over the world. And it's close enough to the actual date of the year that we shouldn't have another problem for thousands of years, and probably won't even have one then, because what the astronomers have taken to doing is adding microseconds or deleting microseconds in years based on slight changes in the Earth's rotation. So we probably won't ever have this problem again.
Thanks, Sandy. Here's hoping. Up next, let's go to Julian. I wonder if he's got a calendar. Listening in Cincinnati, Ohio, listening on 740 AM. Julian, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, that was kind of funny. But anyway, here's my question. Before Paul died, he said that after he lives, grievous wolves shall come to destroy the church. How are we so sure that the grievous wolves that Paul mentioned are not the so-called church fathers?
Okay, from a couple of things. The first one is that now the passage you're quoting is in Acts chapter 18, where Paul is on the way to Jerusalem to be arrested. He's talking to the elders of the church of Ephesus, and he says that these wolves are going to come, and he says some of your own number are going to do this. Notice he says some, not all. And the implication is that these ministers of Christ are, most of them, going to be faithful. This is going to be a minority. That's further suggested by the fact that Jesus says at the end of Matthew, he's going to be with the church until the end of the world. And he says in John's gospel that he's going to send the Holy Spirit, and the Holy Spirit will guide them into all, will guide the disciples into all truth. You also have, back to Paul again, in 1 Timothy, Paul describes the church as the pillar and foundation of the truth. So between all of these other passages, we have a recognition that Jesus and the Holy Spirit are guiding his church in such a way that his church is the pillar and foundation of truth. And therefore, even though there will be wolves who will bring in doctrinal or moral errors, they're going to be the minority. The church itself as a whole is still guided by Jesus, is still guided by the Holy Spirit, and still functions as the pillar and ground of the truth. So given that, we can look at who's leading the church in any age, and by and large, the leaders are going to be doing the right thing. They're not going to be the wolves. And so the church fathers, who were the leaders of the Christian church in the early centuries, they are not the wolves. There will be wolves among them, but the wolves among them will be the heretics and schismatics that they point out and condemn. It's not going to be the church fathers as a whole, because the entire church as a whole is still being guided by Christ and the Holy Spirit and still functions as the pillar and bulwark of the truth.
Thank you, Julian, very much for the question. Appreciate it. I'm sorry I won't get to Ron and Alex, but we got open forum tomorrow.
Let me take a swing at quickly answering them, because I can see their questions.
Okay.
Alex, it is not a sin for a Catholic to be a groomsman in a non-religious wedding in a backyard as long as the wedding's otherwise going to be valid. If neither of the parties are Catholic and it's going to be a valid wedding, you can be a groomsman. Ron, when you pray after receiving communion, whether you're praying to God or Jesus is up to you. Who you're praying to is based on your intention.
Well, there we go. So, Ron and Alex, I hope that that satisfies what you were looking for. Jimmy Akin, thank you so much for being here with us to start the week off. One thing I meant to say while you were on and talk about this is next Monday, 2 hours with you for a special Halloween show.
Yeah.
Weird Halloween questions.
Weird Halloween questions.
So don't miss the big Halloween show with Jimmy. But we'll also have Jimmy later in this week, on Friday, as a matter of fact. Coming up next, Don Johnson. He's got a new film out on the transgender movement. You don't want to miss it.